Welcome to the Smithsonian, published by the treasured national institution that bears its name. The Smithsonian is one of the world's most thoroughly researched and in-depth magazines. Feed your growing curiosity of the world through the Smithsonian, coming up next on your audio reading service.
Welcome. This is the Smithsonian, and I'm your reader, Julie, with the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today I'll be reading from the Smithsonian Magazine, the September 2022 issue. And now I'll begin with Creature Comfort. This is written by Sam Zlotnick. Blankets and bottle feeding at a nursery for orphaned sloths in Costa Rica. A sloth that springs into action does not even seem possible, given the creature's notorious lethargy. But one of the two sloth species in Costa Rica is fast as well as fierce. Like a lion, says Encar Garcia, a conservationist. This unusual species, which is called the Hoffman's two-toed sloth, doesn't hesitate to deploy teeth or its two large foreclaws when threatened. The other species, which has three forefingers and is called the brown-throated sloth, is, she reassures us, more typical, the one that's smiling. Despite their striking differences, both the Hoffman's two-toed sloth and the brown-throated sloth face the same problems when people encroach on their forest habitat. They climb power lines in search of a mate and often get electrocuted. If they come down from the trees, they may be attacked by dogs. Rapid development of forested areas has led to more deaths and injuries, says Garcia. We rescue a sloth almost every day. The organization she co-founded, the Jaguar Rescue Center in Playa Chiquita, takes in orphaned and injured sloths and other mammals such as monkeys and opossums, along with birds and reptiles. Not jaguars, though. The name is a winking acknowledgement of an early effort to rehabilitate a misidentified ocelot. The center provides its patients with food, shelter, and medical care, with the goal of returning animals to the wild. Nursing a helpless baby sloth, which weighs only 10 or 11 ounces, about the size of a grapefruit, requires almost constant attention for several months. Infants are fed goat's milk every 3 hours throughout the day and night until they're ready for a leaf-based diet, usually by 11 months. All the blankets and bottle feeding in the world, though, don't make up for not having a real parent. A baby sloth in the wild will cling to its mother's fur for about 6 months while learning to find leaves that are nutritious and low in toxins. We are not perfect sloth mothers, says Garcia. I mean, we cannot eat leaves. We cannot teach them how to climb in the trees. The rescue center releases one-third to one-half of the sloths it cares for. Once an animal has recovered from an injury or has grown big enough to survive on its own, it's outfitted with a microchip, painted nails, and a colorful braid to identify it. According to the center's latest records, 90% of the sloths released into the wild over the last couple of years are still alive today and thriving in their natural, if shrinking, habitat. Next, we will move to Half the Battle, which is an exclusive book excerpt. The book was written by Matthew F. Delmont. The massive explosion at a Navy yard in California was the deadliest home front disaster of the war. The aftershocks would help transform the armed forces and American society. Many African Americans were eager to serve in the U.S. military during World War II, hoping their patriotism and courage would prove them worthy of the nation's promise of equity for all people. But even as they battled in foreign enemies that threatened our democracy, at home these men and women found themselves fighting the same racism and segregation they had endured as civilians. In a new book, Half American, Matthew F. Delmont, a historian at Dartmouth College, chronicles the service members' struggles, including a momentous but largely forgotten Navy catastrophe that he says helped force the Navy and the larger military to desegregate. At the U.S. Navy Ammunition Depot in Port Chicago on Sayson Bay, some 36 miles northeast of San Francisco, black seamen worked in shifts around the clock loading ships bound for the Pacific. Every day, they transferred hundreds of tons of bombs and shells from railroad boxes to the ships. Sometimes the bombs were wedged so snugly in the boxcars that the sailors struggled to loosen them safely. It was dangerous work, and shortly after 10 p.m. on July 17, 1944, it proved deadly. People throughout the Bay Area awoke to something that felt like an earthquake, a blast with the force of 5 kilotons of TNT. Sailors sleeping in their barracks a mile and a half from the port thought they were under attack from Japanese bombers. Everybody felt at that point that it was another Pearl Harbor, says Jack Crittenden, a 19-year-old seaman from Montgomery, Alabama. People running and hollering. Finally, they got the emergency light together. Then some guys came by in a truck and went down to the dock, but when we got there, we didn't see no dock, no ship, no nothing. One ship, the Quinault Victory, was lifted out of the water, spun around, and shattered into pieces. Only tiny fragments of another ship, the E.A. Bryan, were ever recovered. All the people on the pier, aboard the 2 naval ships, and on a nearby Coast Guard fire barge were killed instantly. 320 people died, including 202 black enlisted sailors. Only 51 bodies were recovered. It was the worst home front disaster of the war. Sailors raced to help injured crewmates and fought fires that could have triggered additional explosions. All of them were shaken by what they witnessed. "I was there the next morning," Crittenden recalled in an interview with historian Robert Allen. "Man, it was awful. You'd see a shoe with a foot in it. You'd see a head floating across the water. Just the head. Or an arm. Just awful. That thing kept you from sleeping at night." One of the seamen had been home in San Diego on leave after his wife gave birth to their son. When he returned to Port Chicago after the explosion and found all of his buddies had been killed, he said something just snapped within him. The black sailors at Port Chicago had voiced their safety concerns numerous times over the prior year. Segregation relegated them to the dangerous task of handling tons of high explosive every day, even though the men were given no specific training. Men learned how to operate winches to move 1,000-pound bombs by watching other sailors operate the machines. White officers pitted different divisions against each other, pushing the sailors to race to load the most tonnage during their shifts. Winners got access to recreational privileges, radios, and black newspapers. But as the pace ratcheted up, so did the risk of an accident. Like other black servicemen assigned to heavy, back-breaking labor, whether in the cold of Alaska or the heat of New Guinea, the black sailors at Port Chicago also chafed at working in segregated units under the supervision of white officers. They described themselves as a chain gang, mule team, and slave outfit, and understood that they were cheap labor compared to civilian stevedores who loaded and unloaded cargo from ships. A year before the explosion, a group of the sailors had written to a local attorney warning that morale had dropped to an alarming depth and asked for help. "We, the Negro sailors of the Naval Enlisted Barracks of Port Chicago, California, are waiting for a new deal," they said in conclusion. "Will we wait in vain?" 4 days after the explosion that destroyed Port Chicago, the Navy began its investigation. 3 senior officers and a judge advocate interviewed 125 witnesses over a month, only 5 of whom were black sailors. The officers deflected blame for prioritizing output over safety and for the seamen's lack of training. Instead, they pointed their fingers at the enlisted men. "The consensus of opinion of the witnesses is that the colored enlisted personnel are neither temperamentally or intellectually capable of handling high explosives," the judge advocate concluded. "It is an admitted fact, supported by the testimony of the witnesses, that there was rough and careless handling of the explosives being loaded aboard ships at Port Chicago." Much in the same way military leaders had blamed black troops for the violence they encountered at army camps in the South, now the Navy blamed black sailors for the port's shoddy safety protocols. Of course, the sailors who were on the Port Chicago dock that July night were not alive to defend themselves from these accusations. Most of the surviving black sailors were eventually transferred to the Naval Barracks in Vallejo, California, near the Mare Island Shipyard and Ammunition Depot. They were in shock and still mourning the deaths of so many of their friends. Men startled at every slammed door and dropped box. Without any information about what caused the explosion, they were anxious about returning to ship loading duty. They already resented their day-to-day treatment as laborers, and now they worried that every bomb they move could be their last. To make matters worse, the Navy gave white officers 30-day survivor's leave to visit their families before returning to regular duty, but denied black sailors the same benefit. As the men worked at the barracks in Vallejo and it became clear they would soon resume duty under the same officers, they began to talk among themselves about refusing to load ammunition. In early August, when the officers tried to march the black sailors to the Mare Island Ammunition Depot, the majority refused to go. The men were told they would face severe penalties if they did not return to work, but the protests persisted. By the end of the afternoon, more than 250 black sailors were imprisoned on a barge, where they were guarded by Marines and held for 3 days. Joseph Small, a sturdily built seaman first class, emerged as a protest leader. The younger sailors respected the 22-year-old Small like an older brother. As tempers flared on the cramped ship, Small urged the men to stick together, remain composed, and avoid getting into trouble with the guards. In the chow hall, he organized the men to cook, serve meals, and clean the kitchen. "We got the officers by the balls. They can do nothing to us if we don't do anything to them," he told the men. "If we stick together, they can't do anything to us." Small and others were optimistic that if they demonstrated they were not refusing to work, only to load ammunition, they would be transferred to other duty. The men did not anticipate that what they saw as work stoppage, akin to a wildcat strike, the Navy saw as mutiny. "As far as we were concerned, mutiny could only be committed on the high seas," Small recalled. "We didn't try to take over anything. We didn't try to take command of the base. We didn't replace any officers. We didn't try to assume an officer's position. How could they call it mutiny?" The sailors would pay dearly for this faulty assumption. When the men were released from the ship, they were marched to a baseball field under armed guard. Admiral Carlton Wright, commander of the 12th Naval District headquartered at Mare Island, arrived in a jeep and proceeded to berate and threaten the black sailors. "I want to remind you that mutinous conduct in the time of war carries a death sentence," Wright said, "and the hazards of facing a firing squad are far greater than the hazards of handling ammunition." Men not long removed from civilian life, who less than a month earlier had seen hundreds of their friends and fellow sailors blown up, were now being told they could be executed if they did not load explosives. When the admiral left, the officers ordered the men to go to one side if they would follow orders to load ammunition, and to the other side if they refused. It was a wrenching decision. The men wept openly as they tried to balance their own lives against their bonds with other black sailors. More than 200 men decided to return to work, and the admiral recommended they be charged with summary courts-martial for refusing to obey orders. When the Navy notified President Franklin Roosevelt of the decision, he wrote, "It seems to me we should remember in the summary courts-martial of these 208 men that they were activated by mass fear and that this was understandable. Their punishment should be nominal." The other 50 men, who refused to load ammunition, were charged with conspiring to make a mutiny. They were transferred 30 miles south to the brig at Camp Shoemaker's and interrogated. The charges the men faced carried lengthy prison sentences and possibly death. The trial began on September 14th before a 7-member court of senior naval officers appointed by Admiral Wright. They served as both judge and jury. Lieutenant Commander James F. Cockley led the prosecution. Lieutenant General Veltman, a 33-year-old Houston lawyer, headed the defense, and the Judge Advocate's Office assigned 5 lawyers to represent groups of 10 men. All of the officers trying and deciding the cases were white. In the courtroom, the senior naval officers were seated directly across from the prosecution and defense, while the black sailors lined the periphery, listening anxiously while their lives hung in the balance. The court-martial of the Port Chicago Seamen was the first U.S. mutiny trial of World War II and the largest mass trial in Navy history. Unusual for military trials, the Navy encouraged newspaper and wire service reporters to cover the proceedings, intending the national publicity to show that the black sailors were receiving a fair trial, while also serving as a warning to other troops who might be tempted to disobey orders. The prosecution argued that the sailors' fear was no excuse for their insubordination, and that the meetings Joseph Small organized aboard the barge constituted a conspiracy to mutiny. The defense countered that the officers asked the sailors if they were willing to load ammunition after the explosion, but had not ordered them to do so. The men refused to move explosives because they were fearful, the defense contended, not conspiring to mutiny. Those men were no more guilty of mutiny than they were of flying to the moon, Veltman argued. The families of the 50 men contacted the NAACP, and Thurgood Marshall, then the director counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund, flew to San Francisco in October to attend the trial and contribute to the sailors' defense. This is not an individual case, Marshall argued. This is not 50 men on trial for mutiny. This is the Navy on trial for its whole vicious policy toward Negroes. Marshall demanded a formal government investigation of Port Chicago, including why black seamen were assigned to segregated labor units and why they were given no safety training before being required to move dangerous explosives. I want to know why the Navy disregarded official warnings by the San Francisco waterfront unions before the Port Chicago disaster that an explosion was inevitable if they persisted in using untrained seamen in the loading of ammunition, Marshall said. I want to know why the Navy disregarded an offer by these same unions to send experienced men to train Navy personnel in the safe handling of explosives. I want to know why the commissioned officers at Port Chicago were allowed to race their men. I want to know why bets ranging from $5 up were made between division officers as to whose crew would load more ammunition. After 6 weeks of hearings, the jury of senior naval officers adjourned to make their ruling. Their deliberations barely extended over the lunch hour before they reached a verdict. They found all 50 black sailors guilty of mutiny. The men were sentenced to between 5 and 15 years in prison. Marshall Riley noted that the officers debated for about a minute and a half for each defendant. He immediately started working on the appeal process, which carried into the following year. The NAACP published Mutiny, a pamphlet ghostwritten by Mary Lindsay, a white reporter for the leftist People's World newspaper, to call attention to the case and urge members to write protest letters to the Navy. The Navy has a slogan, "Remember Pearl Harbor," a reminder of foreign treachery against democracy, the pamphlet concluded. There is another slogan the Navy should adopt. It is a reminder of what treachery to our own ideals within a democracy does to that democracy. The pointless, meaningless deaths of over 320 Americans must be given a point, must be given a meaning for the living. Remember Port Chicago. Marshall took the appeal to the Navy's Judge Advocate General's office in Washington, D.C. He argued that the military was too quick to label any disobedience by black sailors or soldiers as a mutiny, and that the Navy was making scapegoats of the men to cover up the practices that led to the explosion. Marshall's appeal was unsuccessful, and the black sailors spent the rest of the war in the Terminal Island Military Prison in San Pedro, south of Los Angeles. Amid growing pressure to desegregate the military, the Navy eventually shortened the sentence and released the men from prison in 1946. Efforts to clear the sailors' names would continue for decades after the war. Port Chicago was just one of several cases of black military personnel protesting discriminatory treatment. The 12,500 black Seabees, Naval Construction Battalion personnel, did important work for the Navy. They built advanced bases, constructed underwater slips for naval vessels, and offloaded cargo. Like other black military laborers, they worked under white officers. 1,000 black Seabees who had served nearly 2 years overseas in Tolugi and Guadalcanal in the Pacific Theater staged a hunger strike at Camp Rousseau in Point Hueneme, California, after their commanding officer refused to promote black Americans and assign black Seabees only to unskilled manual labor. It is discouraging and destructive to the morale when they see white men with much less preparation than they have and with no more apparent qualifications of leadership than they possess being advanced beyond them, NAACP Acting Secretary Roy Wilkins said. 19 of the Seabees were discharged for seditious behavior. At Freeman Army Airfield in Indiana, more than 100 Tuskegee Airmen officers were arrested when they attempted to integrate an all-white officers' club. I had flown 67 combat missions in Europe, Lieutenant Colonel Clarence Jameson recalled. As an officer of the United States Army Air Corps, who'd put his life on the line for this country? Why couldn't I use the United States Army's Officers Club? The black pilots had endured racism at Tuskegee, from segregated bathrooms on base to violence at the hands of police in town. They had risked their lives and lost friends fighting for a country that threatened them as less valuable than white citizens. Now they were fed up. Their protest happened to take place at an officers' club, but it was about much more than that. It was a slap in the face, Jameson said. It defiled the graves of black pilots who'd made the ultimate sacrifice for their country, but couldn't get into a dive club because of their skin color. At Fort Devens in Massachusetts, 51 black women went on strike to protest racial discrimination in the Women's Army Corps. Many of the women were college graduates and were enticed to enlist in the WAC by promises of skilled jobs, only to be assigned cleaning duty. Alice Young, a 23-year-old from Washington, D.C., who left nursing school to join the WAC, recalled that her hospital commander told her, "I do not have colored WACs as medical technicians. They are here to scrub and wash floors, wash dishes, and do all the dirty work." The four strike leaders, Mary Green, Anna Morrison, Johnny Murphy, and Young, were court-martialed. "If it will help my people by me taking a court-martial, I will be willing to take it," Morrison said. Hundreds of other black soldiers and sailors staged their own individual protests, refusing to obey racially unjust orders from officers, military police, or local sheriffs. Second Lieutenant Jackie Robinson was court-martialed at Camp Hood in Texas in the summer of 1944 when he refused to move to a seat in the back of an Army bus. Robinson was with the light-skinned wife of another black officer, and the two had picked seats in the middle of the bus. The driver glanced into his rear-view mirror and saw what he thought was a white woman talking with a black second lieutenant, Robinson remembered. He became visibly upset, stopped the bus, and came back to order me to move to the rear. I didn't even stop talking, didn't even look at him. I had no intention of being intimidated in moving to the back of the bus. Although Robinson was 3 years away from breaking the color barrier in Major League Baseball, he was already a well-known athlete after starring in four sports at UCLA. Word of his court-martial would likely garner national attention, so after the arrest, Robinson wrote to Truman Gibson, who was chief civilian advisor to the Secretary of War. Robinson asked his advice. "I don't want any unfavorable publicity for myself or the Army, but I believe in fair play, and I believe I have to let someone in on the case," he wrote. "I don't care what the outcome of the trial is because I know I'm being framed and the charges aren't too bad." The court-martial trial moved quickly, and the Army acquitted Robinson, granting his request for exemption from active military service, and honorably discharged him in the fall. The unit Robinson was attached to, the 761st Tank Battalion, nicknamed the Black Panthers, went on to distinguish itself in the Battle of the Bulge as part of General George Patton's Third Army. "Why do Negro soldiers and sailors mutiny?" the Chicago Defender asked. After 73 soldiers in the 1,320th Engineer General Service Regiment in Hawaii were court-martialed and convicted of mutiny. The men worked in a labor battalion, clearing airfields and moving tons of earth. They refused to show up for work after their black officers were transferred. The Chicago Defender argued that the men's defiance was deeply rooted in histories and traditions of black resistance. From slavery to slave labor has been the fate of the Negro who becomes a soldier or sailor. As a slave, the Negro revolted, fought, bled, and died to break the chains that bound him. As slave labor in the Army and Navy, he is doing no less. Marshall and the NAACP were involved in almost all these court-martial and mutiny cases and saw a clear pattern. It is apparent that most of these incidents arose from a final break in the spirit of the Negro soldiers due to continued mistreatment, he said. The tendency in military circles seems to be that any concerted display of resentment against ill treatment among Negro soldiers is called mutiny. The common thread that connected the black sailors at Port Chicago, Seabees at Camp Rousseau, Tuskegee Airmen at Freeman Field, WACS at Fort Devens, and thousands of other troops was through their desire to serve their country without being discriminated against or degraded. As the Chicago Defender put it, the Negro will give his life for his country, but he will not be a slave. We are going to move now to SmithsonianMag.com for the article entitled Elizabeth II was an enduring emblem of the waning British Empire. The British Queen died on Thursday at age 96. This was submitted by correspondent Nora McGreevy. Elizabeth II, the long-reigning British queen who buoyed a shrinking empire and an increasingly embattled monarchy, died on Thursday at Balmoral Castle, her estate in the Scottish Highlands, at age 96. The royal family confirmed her death in a statement saying, "The queen died peacefully at Balmoral this afternoon." The King and Queen Consort will remain at Balmoral this evening and will return to London tomorrow. Elizabeth succeeded her father, George VI, upon his death in 1952, when she was just 25 years old. Over her 70-year reign, the longest of any British monarch and any female monarch in history, she worked with 15 prime ministers, 16 counting Liz Truss, who took office earlier this week, met 13 of the past 14 American presidents, oversaw thousands of royal engagements, and made 89 state visits overseas. The Queen's steady presence symbolized stability during a period of profound change. Under Elizabeth's leadership, the United Kingdom navigated multiple wars, ongoing unrest in Northern Ireland, leaps in technology, economic crises, Brexit, the rise of far-right nationalist politics, pandemics, and the dissolution of a once dominant empire. 4 out of 5 people currently living in the UK were born after the Queen's ascension, making Elizabeth the only monarch most of her subjects have ever known. Per the New York Times, her death marks both the loss of a revered monarch and the end of a figure who served as a living link to the glories of World War II Britain, presided over its fitful adjustment to a post-colonial, post-imperial era, and saw it through its bitter divorce from the European Union. Inside Elizabeth II's reign. Elizabeth was a private person who spent much of her life squarely in the public's gaze. Her June 2, 1953 coronation ceremony aired live to 20 million television viewers, a royal first. Her meticulously planned funeral celebrations will likely be televised, tweeted, TikToked, and shared by millions on social media in the weeks to come. Born Elizabeth Alexandra Mary Windsor on April 21, 1926, the future queen became the UK's heir presumptive at age 10 when her uncle, Edward VIII, abdicated the throne to marry American socialite Wallis Simpson. Conflict defined Elizabeth's teenage years, with World War II breaking out in September 1939. At the behest of Prime Minister Winston Churchill, the princess delivered her first public speech over the radio following year. Speaking in carefully enunciated tones, 14-year-old Elizabeth, or Lilibet as she was known to her family, stood next to her younger sister Margaret and delivered a message of comfort to Britain's children, many of whom have been sent away from their families during the Blitz. Toward the end of the war, in March 1945, the 19-year-old Elizabeth joined the British Army's Auxiliary Territorial Service. She spent her days at a training facility learning how to maintain vehicles and her nights sleeping at nearby Windsor Castle. Her future husband, Prince Philip, served in the Royal Navy. The second cousins, who first met in 1934, exchanged letters throughout the war. Against the advice of royal advisors, Philip and Elizabeth fell in love. They wed in November 1947 and remained together until Philip's death at age 99 in April 2021. The couple is survived by four children, Charles, Anne, Andrew, and Edward. Elizabeth spent her first years as queen attempting to secure Britain's symbolic foothold in a rapidly changing world. After her coronation, she and Philip embarked on a six-month globe-trotting tour that spanned 13 countries in the Commonwealth of Nations, a voluntary association comprising largely of former British colonies. The Commonwealth bears no resemblance to the empires of the past, the Queen said in her inaugural 1953 Christmas broadcast. It is an entirely new conception built on the highest qualities of the spirit of man. To that new conception of an equal partnership of nations and races, I shall give myself heart and soul every day of my life. Elizabeth's reign was marked by rocky periods of intermittent violence abroad, including Britain's botched attempt to gain control of the Suez Canal in 1956, and the Falklands War, a 10-week-long battle with Argentina in 1982. Closer to home, the British Army waged its longest military campaign to date, Operation Banner, an effort to establish order during the Troubles, a bloody sectarian conflict that engulfed much of Northern Ireland between 1968 and 1998. The conflict touched Elizabeth directly in 1979, when the Irish Republican Army assassinated her second cousin, Lord Lewis Mountbatten. That same year, the UK elected its first woman prime minister, Margaret Thatcher. As Thatcher embarked on an ambitious agenda of economic deregulation, the Queen and the Prime Minister enjoyed a tense but respectful relationship. Despite the tumult of post-war British politics, Elizabeth remained staunchly tight-lipped, rarely commenting publicly on current events. She aggressively cultivated a reputation for being impartial, says Brooke Newman, a historian at Virginia Commonwealth University. Elizabeth met with the Prime Minister almost every week of her reign, in addition to leading the annual opening of Parliament. But her involvement in day-to-day politics was fairly limited, and she took great pains to avoid seeming publicly biased toward one political party or another. Other members of the royal family proved more vocal than the Queen. Philip, for one, earned notoriety for making inappropriate and racist comments, while Charles has spoken publicly about a number of political pet projects. As Queen, Elizabeth instead devoted herself to diplomatic duties such as state dinners, visits with dignitaries, and other acts of ambassadorship. Though she took on fewer duties over time, the Queen marked a series of major milestones, including her silver, golden, diamond, sapphire, and platinum jubilees, the last of which she celebrated in February 2022. Elizabeth II and the Smithsonian. Among Elizabeth's countless public engagements were three state visits to the United States, an October 1957 meeting with Dwight D. Eisenhower, the bicentennial of American independence in July 1976 when she was greeted by Gerald Ford, and a May 1991 trip to see George H.W. Bush. Several other U.S. presidents visited Elizabeth at Windsor Castle. In 1982, Ronald Reagan rode horses around the castle grounds with the monarch. The Queen's 1976 visit to Washington, D.C. also included a trip to the Smithsonian Institution, says Richard Curran, the Smithsonian Distinguished Scholar and Ambassador at Large. At the time, he was a young anthropologist working in his very first Smithsonian job. It was the 200th anniversary of the United States, Curran recalls, and we had just opened the National Air and Space Museum, which was a big deal, because that was our country's birthday's present to ourselves. Curators made special arrangements for the visit, transporting the prized Hope Diamond from its high-security home at the National Museum of Natural History to the Smithsonian Castle, where the 45.52-carat diamond was placed in a temporary display case for the Queen's viewing. Elizabeth's visit represented a full-circle moment for the Smithsonian, says Curran. After all, an 1838 donation from Englishman James Smithson established the institution as it's known today. The 104,960 gold sovereigns that made up the cash bore the likeness of a teenaged Queen Victoria. Several sources also suggest that Elizabeth's distant relation, George IV, may have once owned the Hope Diamond himself. Elizabeth's predecessor may have actually possessed the gem, adds Curran, who has written a book on the stone's winding journey from 17th century India to the U.S. The Royal Family in Crisis. The Queen championed the Victorian propriety of her ancestors, a stance that increasingly placed her at odds with the rest of the royal family, whose affairs, spending habits, and personal feuds became fodder for endless celebrity gossip columns by the turn of the 21st century. Still, not even Elizabeth could fully evade criticism. The Queen's finances caught the public's attention in 1992 when a fire burned much of her beloved Windsor Castle to the ground. British commentators balked when the government announced that taxpayers would shoulder the $90 million burden of restoration costs. In response, Elizabeth quickly announced a plan to pay taxes on her personal income, something she had never done before, and dipped into her own substantial reserves to rebuild the castle. The 1992 fire coincided with a maelstrom of negative press for the royal family, including a flurry of highly publicized divorces and a tabloid frenzy over royal scandals. The acclaimed Netflix series The Crown dramatizes many of these incidences, including clashes with prime ministers, reports of Philip's infidelity, and a break-in at Buckingham Palace. In a rare public display of emotion, the Queen dubbed in 1992 a horrible year in her annual Christmas address. In 1997, the Queen attracted criticism in the press for her aloof public response to the death of her daughter-in-law, Princess Diana. More than two decades later, Diana's son, Prince Harry, and his wife, American actress Meghan Markle, described how a culture of racism in the royal family led to their eventual departure from the firm in a tell-all interview with Oprah Winfrey. Elizabeth responded to the allegations with a curt 61-word statement. The Queen also met with judgment for quietly standing by her second son, Prince Andrew, as he faced a civil sexual assault case for allegedly raping a teenager in 2001. Details of the case have since brought Andrew's relationship with convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein into harsh relief. In January 2022, the Queen stripped Andrew of his royal titles and duties. Andrew settled the case out of court for an undisclosed, but likely multi-million-dollar sum. The Queen's image. As the embattled royal family negotiated a seeming unending series of crises, Elizabeth maintained public favor by cultivating an image as a morally unflappable monarch. Among her subjects, support for the Queen and the broader institution of the monarchy varied widely by age group. One recent poll found that 41% of 18 to 24-year-old Brits want to replace the monarchy with an elected head of state. Elizabeth herself, however, has received consistently high public approval ratings, bolstered in the past decade particularly by supporters over the age of 65. When the British think about themselves and their best selves, they think about Queen Elizabeth, Newman says. She's dignified. She's inscrutable. Her feathers are rarely ruffled. She's the face of the nation that they can be proud of. The Queen cut an iconic matriarchal figure. Standing just 5'4", she established a uniform of bright monochromatic outfits and hats that set her apart from the crowd. Accompanied by an entourage of corgis, and in her later years crowned by a cloud of white hair, she became not only the queen, but the defining image of one, says critic Guy Trebe wrote in 2012. She often emphasized, "I have to be seen to believed," says royal historian Carolyn Harris, and she meant that literally. Elizabeth embodied these attributes in a rare televised speech delivered during the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic. Besides her annual Christmas Day addresses, the speech marked only the fifth time that she had addressed the British public in such fashion. "I hope those who come after us will say the Britons of this generation were as strong as any, that the attributes of self-discipline, of quiet, good-humored resolve, and of fellow-feeling still characterize this country," said the Queen, dressed in bright green with a string of pearls on her neck and a bouquet of roses in the background, in April 2020. Some of Elizabeth's domestic popularity can likely be attributed to a sense of colonial nostalgia that has served in the UK in recent years, Newman says. While the Black Lives Matter protests of 2020 prompted some Britons to dismantle symbols of colonialism, nationalist and anti-immigration movements continue to promote a sanitized narrative of British history that overlooks slavery and glorifies imperial ambitions. At its apex just a few years before Elizabeth's birth, the British Empire claimed roughly a quarter of all land on earth. European colonizers, among them enslavers, traders, and investors, including members of the royal family, enriched themselves through the enslavement of African and indigenous people and the appropriation and exploitation of colonies' resources. Powerful anti-colonialism movements chiseled away at the British Empire throughout the 20th century, with countries from India to Kenya successfully lobbying for independence from the UK. While the empire of her ancestors crumbled, Elizabeth dedicated herself to preserving its descendant, the Commonwealth. Officials proposed the organization, which formally coalesced around Indian independence in 1947, as a counterbalance to the centrifugal forces that were drawing the empire apart, writes Philip Murphy, a historian at the University of London, in Monarchy and the End of an Empire. Elizabeth strived to preserve the Commonwealth, and by extension, the monarchy's relevance outside the United Kingdom. She even had the symbols of various Commonwealth countries embroidered on her coronation gown. Her dedication was so evident that in 1996, historian Frank Prochaska quipped that the Queen liked dogs, horses, the Commonwealth, and her grandchildren. The Queen was far and away the most traveled British monarch of all time, visiting former British colonies by boat, train, car, and plane, says Harris. She wielded her power as a diplomat and symbol of British identity to stress unity among the former colonies. One of Elizabeth's earliest public appearances underscored this vision. It was 1947, and the princess and her family were visiting the newly independent South Africa. The following year, the all-white Nationalist Party would begin constructing the racist legal architecture of apartheid, codifying racial inequities inherited from decades of British and Dutch colonization. In a speech delivered on her 21st birthday, the heir apparent appealed to the youth of the British family of nations to defend the principles of liberty, peace, and prosperity in the respective countries, or colonies, as many would not achieve independence until later that century. In our time, we may say that the British Empire has saved the world first and is now to save itself after the battle is won, Elizabeth said. If we all go forward together with an unwavering faith, a high courage, and a quiet heart, we shall be able to make of this ancient Commonwealth, which we all love so dearly, an even grander thing, more free, more prosperous, more happy, and a more powerful influence for good in the world than it has been in the greatest days of our forefathers. She concluded with a promise. I declare before you that all my whole life, whether it be long or short, shall be devoted to your service and the service of our great imperial family to which we all belong, the fate of the Commonwealth of Nations. 75 years later, the Commonwealth boasts 54 member countries. It functions as the surviving remnants of the British Empire, according to Newman, and exists mainly as a trade and political organization. Membership is technically open to all countries. Rwanda, for instance, joined the fold in 2009, despite lacking historic ties to the UK. Whether Commonwealth countries will continue to voluntarily continue their relationship with the Crown, particularly as more countries weigh the royal symbolic roles as emissaries of empire, is unclear. As the primary spokesperson for the royal family, Elizabeth acknowledged but did not apologize for a long list of British imperial crimes committed in centuries past. The Crown continues to deny growing calls for reparations from former colonies. Without Elizabeth's careful stewardship, the future of the Commonwealth hangs in the balance. The position of head of Commonwealth that Elizabeth occupied for so many years is not hereditary and will not transfer automatically to her successor, the newly ascended Charles. The late monarch boasted extremely high public approval ratings. Charles, by contrast, is a much more divisive public figure. The heir waited a record-breaking 70 years to ascend to the throne. His track record led some to speculate that Prince William, his eldest son, would take the crown instead. Commonwealth leaders informally agreed to elect Charles as their head in 2018, but this could always change, Newman says. Member states could also follow Barbados's lead and cast off the monarchy once and for all. The island nation became a republic in December 2021, but remained part of the Commonwealth. The time has come to fully leave our colonial past behind, wrote Prime Minister Mia Amor-Motley of the decision. Barbadians want a Barbadian head of state. 14 nations continue to recognize the British Crown as their ceremonial head of state: Australia, Canada, New Zealand, Tuvalu, Antigua and Barbuda, the Bahamas, Belize, Grenada, Jamaica, Papua New Guinea, St. Lucia, the Solomon Islands, St. Kitts and Nevis, and St. Vincent and the Grenadines. It remains to be seen whether these countries will pledge their loyalty to Charles or, pushed over the edge by the Queen's death, echo Barbados's example. Elizabeth has cobbled together the Commonwealth basically through the force of her personality since 1952, says Newman. But Britain's once dominant role in world politics has waned, and the end of Elizabeth's platinum reign could trigger another wave of anti-colonial efforts in former British colonies near and far. Now, the historian adds, the Commonwealth could just unravel completely. We will go now to Smart News for an article submitted by Daily correspondent Sarah Kuta. Federal flood maps are outdated because of climate change, FEMA director says. The maps don't take into account intense rainfall events like those plaguing many parts of the country this summer. To help keep residents safe and minimize damage to homes and businesses, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, FEMA, maintains nationwide maps that indicate the risk of flooding in various areas. But human-caused climate change has thrown a wrench into those maps. Record rainfall events are becoming more common, and they're causing unexpected levels of flooding in places that aren't marked as vulnerable in FEMA's guidance. The organization's director, Deanne Criswell, admitted as much during an interview on CNN's State of the Union on Sunday. FEMA's maps right now are really focused on riverine flooding and coastal flooding, she told CNN's Dana Bash on the program. When we're seeing these record rainfalls that are happening, that's what our flood maps don't necessarily take into consideration. Asked whether FEMA plans to update these maps in response to the evolving climate, Criswell confirmed that federal disasters officials would continue to work with all of our local jurisdictions to help them better identify what their needs are and help them create better predictive models. She didn't elaborate on when or how any updates to the maps would occur. It's hard to predict when we're going to see rain events like that, right? And the status of infrastructure to be able to support that, she says to CNN, adding that the country needs to start thinking about what the threats are going to be in the future as a result of climate change in order to mitigate them. Criswell's comments came after she visited Jackson, Mississippi, where more than 180,000 residents have been without drinking water since late August because of flood damage caused by intense rainfall. Other communities, too, have suffered because of flooding this year. On Sunday, the governor of Georgia declared a state of emergency after excessive rainfall flooded homes, cars, and streets in the northwestern part of the state. Floods have also hit St. Louis, Yellowstone, Death Valley, Kentucky, Dallas, Illinois, and parts of the Southwest this summer. As the maps are drawn now, FEMA considers some 8.7 million properties to be located within flood hazard areas. But according to 2020 modeling by the nonprofit First Street Foundation, as many as 14.6 million properties could actually be at high risk of floods. That means roughly 6 million property owners may not understand their region's risk and consequently may be underinsured. The nonprofit predicts the number of properties prone to flooding will grow to 16.2 million by 2050 because of climate change. Without good flood maps, communities that use FEMA's guidance to determine where it's safe to construct buildings and other infrastructure are operating with inaccurate information. Likewise, mortgage lenders are using outdated maps to calculate how much property owners need to pay for flood insurance. Last fall, FEMA updated its risk rating methodology for determining flood insurance prices, a change that has led to a more expensive premiums for an estimated 3 million homeowners. Hundreds of thousands of homeowners have dropped flood insurance since FEMA made the change in October 2021, at a time when it is more important than ever for people living in flood zones to buy insurance, as Lilia Yuns writes for Grist. FEMA, for its part, has warned for years that people who live outside of a designated flood zone are nonetheless susceptible to flooding, as Thomas Frank wrote for E&E News last month. Still, as climate change continues to make flooding worse, information and transparency for consumers and homebuyers and renters about flood risk is crucial, no matter where it comes from, as Laura Lightbody, the Flood Prepared Communities Project Director at the Pew Charitable Trust, told the Washington Post's Andrew Freeman, Brady Dennis, and Lars Karklis in June 2020. We'll close today with more smart news. Nebraska man makes world's longest journey by pumpkin boat. The trip down the Missouri River took some 12 hours. This was submitted by Michelle Harris. Late last month, Nebraska resident Dwayne Hansen celebrated his 60th birthday by setting sail in an 846-pound pumpkin and traveling 38 miles down the Missouri River. The purpose of the trip, which began the morning of August 27 at the Bellevue Marina and culminated 12 hours later in Nebraska City at the Riverview Marina, was to earn the Guinness World Book title for the longest journey by pumpkin boat, per the Omaha World Herald's Margie Ducey. Before Hansen, the record holder was Rick Swenson, who sailed the Red River between Minnesota and North Dakota by pumpkin boat in 2016, according to the Guinness World Records. Hansen spent years on the project, eventually naming his prized pumpkin Berta, he told News Channel's Nebraska Dan Swenson. He was inspired to break the record after attending a three-day pumpkin growing seminar in Portland, Oregon, 5 years ago, when he met a woman who at that time held the record he sought. "I asked her a lot of questions, and that's when I decided I wanted to do this," he tells News Channel Nebraska. With a circumference of around 146 inches, Hansen determined that the pumpkin was large enough for him to fit inside after he carved it out. Dubbed the SS Berta, the pumpkin was transported to the launching point atop a trailer, according to the Washington Post's Maria Luisa Pirro. Hansen hopped inside and took off for the day-long journey, with family members and friends cheering him on from along the banks. Throughout the next 12 hours, he fought to stay afloat as an array of obstacles, including rocks, sandbars, and waves, threatened to tip him over. "You've got to be on top of it the whole time," he tells News Channel Nebraska. To comply with the Guinness World Records rules, Hansen had asked non-family members to witness the event. Attendees included Bellevue city officials who took photos and videos along the way to provide evidence. The inspiration for the Guinness Book of Records, as it was originally called, came about after Sir Hugh Beaver, the managing director of Guinness Brewery, went on a hunting trip to Ireland in 1951. After failing to shoot a golden plover, he debated with his hunting party party over what the fastest game bird was, only to realize that they couldn't find the answer in any reference book. Unnerved by the group's failure to arrive at a consensus during their pub argument, Beaver recruited fact-finding researchers, twin brothers Norris and Ross McWhitter, in 1954, and tasked them with putting together a reference book of facts and figures. The first edition was published on August 27, 1955, the same day that Hansen set sail for the Pumpkin Expedition 67 years later. Since then, Guinness World Records, it changed its name in 1999, has sold over 150 million books. From the longest human tunnel traveled through by a skateboarding dog to the longest fingernails on a pair of hands, over 60,000 records exist on the site's database. Hansen's record isn't official quite yet. Kylie Galloway, a spokesman for Guinness World Records, tells CNN that the organization has received its application and is currently in the process of reviewing it. Well, that's all the time we have for today. This has been Julie with the Smithsonian. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana.